It's Friday, October 30th, UTC, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, we'll check in with VOA's State Department correspondent on a first-of-its-kind meeting in Vienna about how to solve the Syrian crisis. We'll also find out why many U.S. farmers are excited about the recently agreed Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal and... We'll preview a new U.S. musical based on the lives and hits of Gloria and Emilio Estefan. That's all ahead on International Edition. Diplomats from 17 countries plus the United Nations and European Union have launched talks in Vienna on Syria's political future. The meeting is the first of its kind because it includes both Russia and Iran, two countries that have long backed Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Our State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins is in the Austrian capital, and earlier I asked her where the Syrian talks are being held.
Well, the bulk of the talks are taking place at the Imperial Hotel here in Vienna, although there have been some bilateral meetings at the nearby Bristol Hotel. This is the hotel that I'm staying in, as well as the other State Department correspondents. Earlier today, I did see Secretary Kerry down in the lobby of this hotel, along with French Foreign Minister Fabius. The French Foreign Minister did stop and speak to us. He said that the first step was to find ways to conduct the fight against terrorist groups in Syria in a more efficient way. He said after that, a political transition had to be organized. Shortly after he left, the German Foreign Minister Steinmeier came through our lobby. He said it would not be possible to resolve all of the issues today, but that today's meeting was an important first step.
Well, what are the expectations among the various participants in this meeting of any progress?
There are mixed views on whether or not there will be progress. One interesting thing to note is that Iran is here. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif is leading a delegation in what really marks a higher diplomatic presence for Iran on the international scene. Iran, like Russia, of course, has been backing Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, whereas the bulk of the other nations are more in favor of a political transition that in the long term does not involve President Assad. Notably also on the other side, Saudi Arabia, which is Iran's arch rival, also has a presence here. So it's going to be interesting to see how the two sides are going to work through these differences and come up with a plan. There has been a lot of talk that this meeting will not produce a final outcome, but may perhaps set the groundwork for future talks.
Well, how unusual is it that you have a Saudi official negotiating alongside an Iranian one here?
This is very unusual, and it, I'm sure, will add to the dynamics of the meetings that are taking place, especially considering the differences in the point of view. Earlier today, Secretary Kerry had a bilateral meeting with Egypt's foreign minister, and this was before the main session with all of the participants got underway. I asked him as he went into that meeting if he felt confident about reaching a resolution today. Kerry said that he was hopeful that negotiators could find a way forward, but he added that it was very difficult. And as I said, officials have indicated that this may not result in a final resolution today, but this may be one in a series of meetings to try to find a consensus on Syria.
And are those talks just expected to go on for today, or could there be another negotiating session on Saturday?
Saturday is unlikely because the Secretary Kerry, leaves here and he goes on to several destinations in Central Asia. But, of course, there is a possibility, of course, of talks next week and in the future. It seems very likely that these participants, or at least most of them, will try together at some future date to continue this conversation.
All right. Well, thank you very much to our State Department correspondent in Vienna, Pam Dawkins.
Thank you.
It's time for a look at what is trending in the social media world, and I'm here today in the studio with Olin Akosholu. Olin, what have you got today?
Hi, Michael. Well, one trending story is yesterday the European Union Parliament voted to tell European governments to drop charges against NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden by a margin of 285 to 281, even calling him a human rights defender. This morning, it was a top trend on Facebook. Of course, the resolution is non-binding, and all the EU member states still have extradition treaties with the U.S.
Well, how are people reacting to that vote by the European Union Parliament?
So the reactions on social media are pretty mixed, as you would probably expect based on the previous opinion of the whistleblower. You have people congratulating him on Twitter. Some people are really disappointed at the decision. Others are surprised that the vote was so close. You might remember it was a pretty big story a couple weeks ago when Snowden actually made his own Twitter account, and he got nearly a million followers in one
yeah,
day.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Right. Well, he put out three tweets from his account right after he had confirmed the news of the European Parliament vote, and all of those tweets received at least 3,000 retweets and favorites each. And another story that's becoming a top trend is a reported case of someone contracting the bubonic plague in the U.S., In Crook County, Oregon, the Oregonian is reporting that a girl contracted the disease on a hunting trip, likely from a flea bite, and she's currently recovering in an intensive care unit.
Well, how worried are people about this case of bubonic plague in the States?
Well, you know, it seems like when people hear about the bubonic plague, they think of the terrible epidemic that killed millions of people in the Middle Ages. But the plague still exists. In the U.S., there are, on average, 7 cases reported each year. That's according to the CDC.
And if, that's the Centers for Disease Control.
That's right.
Right.
But if caught early, it is treatable with antibiotics. So some people seem worried, but you have others pointing out that the plague does exist and certainly isn't as lethal these days. Also, since Halloween is tonight, if you're still looking for a costume, do a search for medieval bubonic plague doctor mask. It's very scary.
Well, I don't know about you, but I gave up wearing Halloween costumes a long time ago, and I am not wearing that.
Probably for the best.
Yeah. All right, well, thanks very much, Olin Akosholu, with our social media segment today. You're listening to VOA News.
This is BizBeat.
At a farmhouse outside of Rome, milk is being heated in a churn to make yogurt. But Sedu Bald and Ismail Mawada used to pick fruit at Italian farms under poor conditions and poor pay. $2 an hour if they got paid at all. The men immigrated from different parts of Africa years ago. Today they run their own successful dairy business, selling their yogurt to clients in Rome with partner Cheikh Diop. Diop says, at Rosarno in southern Italy, we picked oranges during the winter in the rain. It was cold, there was no heat, and you slept in shacks. The name of the yogurt is Barakama, which means resilient, representing the long struggle it took to make it in another country. Today, the men sell 250 liters of yogurt a week, enough money for a living wage, and they also grow and sell organic vegetables. A main entry point for migrants. Some 180,000 people arrived in Italy the first 8 months of this year. From VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
I'm Michael Lippin with VOA's International Edition. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is one of the most expansive trade agreements ever, bringing together nearly 40% of the global economy. The TPP agreement now awaits full ratification by the 12 participating countries, and in the meantime, the debate about its benefits and costs continues in the United States. As VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports, U.S. farmers generally support the agreement, hoping it will make it easier for them to compete globally.
It's a good year for Illinois farmer Monty Whipple. Abundant rainfall early in the growing season produced abundant crops of corn and soybeans. As he harvests this year's crop, he's also looking far beyond his fields to new customers and increased demand, thanks to the TPP agreement.
I'm basically all for it.
Whipple knows he's not the only supplier in the global market of corn and soybeans. He says the TPP appears to give U.S. farmers the edge on exporting grain to Asian markets.
I think it behooves us to be a part of the game and reach some agreements with these people so that they come to us instead of looking elsewhere for their products.
Well, Brazil and Argentina are very happy to ship over there.
The demand for quality grain in Asia became clear to Wendell Shawman when he traveled to the region as the U.S. Grains Council chairman. That demand is driving increased competition, which is why he also supports the TPP.
One of the slogans we created a few years ago is when trade works, the world wins.
But TPP critics say not everyone wins. The AFL-CIO blames the 1994 North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, for the loss of as many as 700,000 U.S. jobs, many of them in manufacturing. Shawman concedes NAFTA also affected certain agricultural sectors.
Some of the fruits and vegetable people probably could not compete with Mexico on that.
The concern over job losses that could come with implementation of the TPP is not lost on farmer Monty Whipple.
That's always going to be a bit of a concern, but if we can increase our exports by exporting many of the things that we're really capable of and greatly capable of producing, such as agricultural products, that'll keep the jobs here.
Whipple says having the TPP in place reduces one challenge farmers face, market uncertainty, so they can focus more on preparing for the greater unknown, the weather, and future crop yields. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Utica, Illinois.
Well, staying with agriculture, we're going to look now at the plight of farmers in Nepal, India, and Bhutan, where disaster struck on October 23rd. That's when an intense hailstorm destroyed the farmers' rice and other crops. To make matters worse, most of those farmers do not have insurance. But VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports that non-governmental organizations have been devising insurance schemes to help such farmers.
Farmers losing their entire crops is an all-too-frequent phenomenon, so it would seem natural they would desire insurance for protection. As Rose Guslinga in Nairobi, a pioneer in the field, discovered, it was initially difficult to market crop insurance to small farmers.
People didn't trust it. People thought, I'm going to wait and see what happens. I'm not sure if I need it this year. They would look at the sky. There's going to be rain, so I don't need to buy it this year.
Richard Leffley, the chief executive officer of MicroInsure, says the insurance has been priced too high, even for those farmers who want to purchase it.
The product may cost, say, 10% plus distribution costs. It might cost $12 to buy a product that would pay out $100 in the event of a bad harvest. But the farmers are only really willing to pay somewhere in the region of $3 to $5 for that product. That's been our experience.
A breakthrough, explains Guslinga in Kenya, came by marketing crop insurance as a bundled product through entities that serve farmers.
Banks that are looking to lend to agriculture, seed companies, fertilizer companies. If it doesn't rain, they don't sell any seed or fertilizer.
The Kalimo Salama model, with which Guslinga has been involved, has provided insurance to about 200,000 farmers in East Africa, mainly in Kenya, Rwanda, and Tanzania.
As agriculture in Africa becomes more business-oriented, that becomes profitable, we're seeing people pick up things like insurance as well.
As mobile phones get into the hands of even the most remote farmers, reliable electronic payouts are becoming more common, giving policyholders additional assurance. The traditional type of individual loss-based insurance is not always viable because it is so expensive to verify losses on large numbers of small land holdings. Leftley, who runs MicroInsure, says that has led to index-based insurance for smallholder farmers for weather-related risks.
Traditionally, insurance would look at what the yield was, and then it wouldn't differentiate between whether it was from locusts or hail or from too much rainfall. It would cover all of those. These index products, the disadvantage is that they can only really pay out for specific events for which an index can be measured remotely, like rainfall or wind speed.
Pramod Agarwal, a regional director in New Delhi for the Consultative Group for International Agricultural Research, says that kind of product cannot gauge the damage, for example, caused by the October 23rd Himalayan hailstorm, a relatively rare type of risk to South Asian farmers until recently.
So we don't have very well-developed hailstorm insurance, so this is something that's worrying farmers a lot.
Agarwal cautions that with climate change forecast to make weather variables more extreme, all kinds of farmers will confront new challenges. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
This is VOA.
Here's science in a minute. Scientists and engineers have spent a lot of time over the years trying to design and build robots that mimic human activities such as walking and talking. Now, a group of engineers from Oregon State University say that they've been able to come up with the most realistic human walking system for robots that has ever been created. The Oregon engineers base their human-like locomotion system on a concept called spring mass walking, which applies computer control to various mechanical systems. The idea, they say, would help robots maintain their balance, traverse rough terrain, and basically walk just like humans. The engineers say that with more research and fine-tuning, their system could give robots even more versatility and performance, and could also, someday, help people with disabilities. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Well, how young is too young for girls to work as models? Recently, a 14-year-old model opened a Christian Dior show in Paris. And as Faiza El-Masri tells us in this report narrated by Faith Lapidus, the young beauty's run on the catwalk renewed an ongoing debate about the use of teenage models.
There's many a child who's dreamed of growing up and living the glamorous life of a fashion model. 14-year-old Sophia Machetner is living that dream and enjoying it, despite some who say she's too young.
I feel ready and I am not alone. I am being looked after closely. They are treating me really nicely here. Everything I ask for is being taken care of. They help me. So the fact that I am 14 years old is not really an issue.
It's not an issue for her manager either.
She was cleaning houses with her mother. So if she's not too young to clean houses, I don't think she's too young to walk on a show.
But others, like Carolyn Rush with the British Fashion Council, are not so sure.
So all of the designers that are contracted to show London Fashion Week, all of the models must be age 16 or over. And we think that's really important.
Yes, there are rules. In Italy, we don't use models that are under 16. They are too young.
Models themselves have their own take on how young is too young.
I think you should start modeling at 18. I mean, that's the age I started at.
You know, you do get scrutinized, you do get disappointments, and that's very hard to say when you're 14 or 16. 18, you're a little bit more experienced. But even at 18, I was saying, you know, I was probably ready by 21, 22.
The Karl Lagerfeld of the Chanel Fashion House says the public wants to see young models, like 16-year-old Lily Rose Depp.
They can identify, even if it's not the same age group, that the girls of the moment, you know. Fashion is about the moment. I'm an opportunist, a fashion opportunist, but there's nothing bad about that because that's our business.
And it remains to be seen if the business is going to continue to allow children to be the new face of fashion. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
A new musical based on the lives and music of American pop stars Gloria and Emilio Estefan opens in New York on November 5th. As VOA's International Edition's David Byrd reports, the show called On Your Feet looks at the groundbreaking Grammy Award-winning couple who gave the world hits such as Conga, 1-2-3, and Get On Your Feet.
Anna Villafañe is a lifelong fan of Gloria Estefan. She even attended the same Miami, Florida high school as the seven-time Grammy-winning singer, Our Lady of Lourdes Academy. Now she gets to work with and to portray the star in the new musical, On Your Feet. Villafañe learned of a Miami open casting call last year, but was not able to attend. She sent the casting office a video audition, and within 3 days was called to audition for the Estefans and Tony-winning director Jerry Mitchell. Anna says that the role, her Broadway debut, is not only the fulfillment of a dream, but also a big responsibility.
I mean, to be chosen to play this part and to step into these shoes, it's a huge deal, you know, because she's not just who she is, and it's not because she's a star, and it's not because she's such a diva, which she rightfully is. it's more because I think of the person that she is and the and what she represents to so many people, to not just the Latin community, I think on the world stage, because she broke a lot of barriers in being herself and in being herself without being a stereotype and without being cliche.
The musical also stars Josh Segarra as Emilio Estefan. Segarra says that he has seen the cultural barriers shift in theater, where Latin actors and actresses are not defined by their ethnicity and don't have to fit into stereotypical roles.
We now get to play characters that happen to be Latino. Mm-hmm. They happen to be Cuban and happen to be El Salvadorian and happen to be Puerto Rican, and it's not defining us anymore. So to get to play a man that has broken walls, that's broken barriers, that's an honor. You know, I get to kind of live through that a little bit. I get to say some pretty important stuff in this show. We get to share some pretty important moments in this show, and we get to live it every night. So as an artist, you can only grow from that.
Ana Villafañe says the play shows some of the struggles the Estefans went through to stay true to their identity and to their vision.
You know, she tells me stories all the time about when she would get somewhere and, you know, certain concert venues would be like, oh, we want to put, like, you know, fruits on your head and, like, you know, red lipstick and this and that, and just the what you would stereotypically think. And she would say, no, I'm going out in leather and I'm going out in chaps. And she kind of, you know, she didn't have to be any certain mold. She created one.
On Your Feet features choreography by four-time Drama Desk Award nominee and Olivier Award winner Sergio Trujillo. The book is by Academy Award winner Alexander Dinilaris. The score includes original orchestrations by Gloria and Emilio Estefan, and several members of the original Miami Sound Machine are in the orchestra. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
That's it for International Edition on The Voice of America. Your director today was Steve Koresh, and the engineer was Skip Sisk. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. You can find me on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. And the show is there, too. We are at VOA_IE. We'd love to hear from you on Twitter, and hope you have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States congratulates the people of Ukraine for exercising their right to vote in the first round of local elections. Ukraine's democracy, said State Department spokesperson John Kirby, remains resilient despite facing difficult economic conditions and Russia's actions in Ukraine, including the occupation of Crimea. According to initial reports from international observers, these elections largely reflected the will of the Ukrainian people and general respect for the democratic process. These local elections are an important step for Ukraine as it continues to move forward with difficult reforms to decentralize political power. This decentralization is shifting more decision-making and budgetary powers down from the capital in Kiev to local communities. The United States looks forward to a successful second round of elections on November 15th for those mayoral races where no single candidate received a majority of the votes. We further expect that those in Mariupol and other areas where voting could not take place to get a chance to exercise their franchise on November 15th, said Mr. Kirby. In the wake of Russia's move to illegally annex Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula, Russian-backed separatists staged an uprising in eastern Ukraine. For the past 17 months, they have been fighting Ukrainian government forces who are attempting to dislodge them from the Donbas. As a result, some 8,000 people were killed and well over 2 million have been displaced, about 1.4 million of them internally. The United States hopes that citizens living in the conflict zone, internally displaced persons, and refugees will soon have the opportunity to exercise their right to choose their leaders in compliance with Ukrainian law and the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe standards, and as called for in the Minsk agreements.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.